I think the black pill that we took was people talk a lot about the blockchain trilemma, but I don't think that that's practically what most devs are optimizing for. I think they're optimizing for a much more practical trilemma of where they can get access to users, other developers for integrations, and liquidity or capital, right? As opposed to necessarily decentralization, scalability, security, which of course you want to be able to check either way. So I think the second realization that we had was that it's really important for applications to have a reason to exist on chain A versus chain B.
Hey everyone, if you have been listening to Empire, you know that Santi and I are fed up with unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds that make the on-chain experience basically unusable. So the Arbitrum team reached out and they showed us the platform. They showed us what you can do on Arbitrum. Whatever you're doing, you can experience frictionless transactions at lightning speed on Arbitrum. So head over to portal.arbitrum.io and check it out. What's up, everyone? Before we jump into today's episode, I'm excited to share Empire's first ever security partner. Harpy is the best tool to prevent your wallet from theft in real time. Harpy is not just a security solution, they are a peace of mind solution. But don't just take our word for it. Harpy is the only wallet security solution that protected 100% of its users from attacks like the Ledger one in Q4, which was an off-chain signature attack. To learn more about Harpy, click the link in the show notes or visit harpy.io/empire. This episode is brought to you by Supra, an Oracle provider across more than 50 different blockchains. If you are building anything in crypto, you likely need verifiable randomness and you need oracles. Well, for Empire listeners, Supra is now offering a limited deal. It is 12 months of Supra free for any Empire listener. You can go to supra.com, that's supra.com/blockworks. Limited time only. Go check it out. Thanks, Supra, for sponsoring Empire.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Today we have Smokey, the co-founder of Barrachain. I've had the privilege of seeing Smokey in the Barra team build as an early investor, and I'm very excited to bring him on. I think it's going to be a great discussion, talking about all things Barrachain, everything that's happening under the hood, which is a lot, and I think a lot of people are appreciating. So anyway, Smokey, thanks for coming on, and it's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Santi. Glad to be here. Should be a lot of fun. I've observed from the sidelines before, but cool to be having a little fun in the spotlight as well.
Yeah. So for context, Smokey pinged me. We were supposed to record this 3 days ago, and he said, "Look, I have COVID. I just came back from Denver." I think he still has COVID. So this is one of the hardest working MFs out there, and this is testament. He still has COVID, and he's here showing up. So thanks for doing that. So tell us a little bit about the story of the conception of building Barrachain and kind of the 0-to-1 moment.
Yeah, for sure, man. And yeah, I'll apologize in advance for any coughing fits or slightly prepubescent sounding voice. I promise it's not always like this, but conference flu got us good and well this year. Like there were like 10 plus bears in Denver, and we threw like an all day event called Bearpalooza. And I think somewhere in the, shaking thousands of hands or whatever, I got wrecked, so wouldn't be the
Bears
first time.
Get COVID.
Who would have thought, right? Who would have thought? Yeah, man. So to answer the actual question, I think we very much subscribe by accident to the whole idea of like, something interesting will start out looking like a toy. For context, myself and my co-founder Papa have been in the crypto space since like 2015. So started just buying ETH and Bitcoin, all the fun stuff when we were, doing our services or spending our tour of duty in the valley, if you will, and building our first companies. And I think when you just see enough smart people moving in a given direction, you're like, okay, cool. Like, I should probably not fade this. Like either everyone else is stupid or I'm stupid. And we definitely do have a habit of betting on our own stupidity, which Barrachain has perhaps been an extended exercise in. So over time, I think that we saw a bunch of fun stuff come and go. We saw the shitcoin slash like the ICOs of 2017, 2018. We saw like DeFi summer actually kick off. We saw like some of the cool stuff from DeFi 1.0. And I think it was in like summer of 21 when we saw Parallel start to take off at the same time as like a bunch of these DeFi communities were ripping, whether that's Ohm, Alchemix, Olympus, et cetera, or, Curve, Frax, et cetera. And we're like, okay, cool. Like, all this funky stuff is happening on chain. And now for the first time, there's like what looks like a pretty high quality game with like, this whole like Magic the Gathering slash Hearthstone on chain vibe. And there's all these like high quality NFTs that they're putting out. So Pop and I had been spending a bunch of time in like these DeFi discords at the same time as like, paying attention to Parallel and like playing the first couple of pack drops and whatnot. And it was like, huh, like maybe there's something fun that we can do more than anything for just shits and giggles. Like there was no grand end vision of a chain. There was just like, hey, what if we made some NFTs for fun, you know, sold them to some of our friends, see if they're into it, and then kind of just like, you know, wing it from there. And that was honestly the genesis of all this, which is very like fucked and hilarious in hindsight, honestly. And we, you know, Papa drew 100 JPEGs of Bear smoking weed, and we literally uploaded them in the, like the most hood manner possible, like OpenSea store tokens, not even like, you know, proper ERCs, and raffled them off in a whole bunch of different DeFi discords. So a bunch of these went out to like the Ohm community, a bunch of these went out to like Frax, a bunch of these went out to like Curve and Alchemix and stuff. And they were like being sold at 0.069 ETH or something. Back in the days where, I guess back when ETH was 4K again-ish. So, you know, not enough to really put people out a bunch, but definitely not like your oh my God, this is such an overpriced NFT mint kind of moment. And we ended up with a very like interestingly distributed community. You had on one hand, these groups who were just like highly DeFi native, highly DeFi centric, spent all their time thinking about the next on-chain game. And then you had these people who were like, oh cool, funny JPEG of a bear, I'm going to buy it because I like NFTs. And I think somewhere in that mix, we ended up striking a really nice mix of like left curve and right curve, and ended up with like a pretty cool, I'd say, version of what we think about a lot is like, you know, just a barbell or a horseshoe theory kind of thing, where you have like the far left and the far right intersecting. And we actually just ended up like talking with these guys over time. And as we, you know, did that, we also made a series of honoraries for like some of our friends on CT, so folks like Zeus and DCF God and so on and so forth. And we were, you know, talking to some of those friends and we're like, you know, what if we found a way to take this a little bit beyond like your standard, you know, kind of like wacky NFT project and added a little bit of like game theory to it. So we decided to make the JPEGs of the bears rebase. And we're like, cool, we're going to, you know, have collections. We're not exactly going to have like 1600% APY and rebase three times a day, but we'll allow for a cool distribution mechanism. That means that we can put out a new collection every couple of months and let that, you know, that supply decentralize over time, while basically awarding initial holders. So people who held one of the initial bears ended up with like one of the second collection. People who held those two ended up with another two. So you could go from like 1 to 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, you know, 32, et cetera, bears. And I think that was the point at which we decided to do the thing that I think that I found less of my protocol founder friends doing, and the thing that like, you know, YC, et cetera, just kind of beats into your head, which is to A, try to make something that people want, and B, to actually talk to your users and, you know, find 100 people that love the idea of what you're doing, and even better, actually love an interactive product. And as we talked to more and more of these people within like this barbell group, as I mentioned, we had a bunch of folks who were fairly technical, who were running nodes, who had been, you know, involved in like, you know, basically running nodes since like ETHGenesis, et cetera. And we had them like fairly on-chain nowadays. And the question that we found them asking quite a bunch was, I guess like this logical trade-off or this fallacy of liquidity and security in their interaction on chain, in that if they had a given pool of capital, they had to choose to either allocate that to staking with a validator, you know, an ETH, or to, you know, on-chain liquidity and Uniswap, Aave, whatever it might be. And it was very like nonsensical that by contributing to the security of the network, they were inherently detracting from the liquidity or the on-chain activity, and vice versa, right? And I think we certainly believe that like LSTs are a meaningful step in the right direction there. But this is also like, you know, mid late 21, early 22. Eigenlayer was barely a concept that people knew about. And even still, you know, as we think about this in the context of today, I think Eigenlayer is super interesting, but isn't necessarily all encompassing in terms of liquidity. It's more about, you know, what can one do with ETH in all of its different forms. And we basically thought to ourselves, would it be possible to build a network that actually allowed you to fundamentally align incentives between security and liquidity at the protocol level? And I think that this was sort of bolstered by another set of, you know, realizations that we had while playing these different chain rotations and exploring all the different alt L1s, whether that's, you know, Near and Santiago, if I recall correctly, you were pretty involved in that ecosystem at one point, or AVAX or Phantom or anything in between. And just seeing more than anything else, like ecosystems with hundreds of millions of dollars, if not billions, sitting relatively inactive in their validator sets, like contributing to network security while the chain itself was just dead, like absolute ghost town. And or the applications living on top of it, if not entirely dead, were entirely devoid of any reason to exist on chain A versus chain B, right? Like I think the black pill that we took was people talk a lot about the blockchain trilemma, but I don't think that that's practically what most devs are optimizing for. I think they're optimizing for a much more practical trilemma of where they can get access to users, other developers for integrations, and liquidity or capital, right? As opposed to necessarily decentralization, scalability, security, which of course you want to be able to check either way. So I think the second realization that we had was that it's really important for applications to have a reason to exist on chain A versus chain B. And I don't think that a reason that lasts, it's simply like, hey, we gave you a grant, now you can live for 2 months. I think that it actually has to be much more mechanistically enshrined and much more, I'd say, closely intertwined with the application itself. And that's sort of where that second extension of proof of liquidity came to mind, which is, okay, can we allow any form of liquidity, including that contributed to or that derived from other applications living on a network, to actually become part of chain security? And that's basically my long-winded answer for, you know, how we thought about BearChain. It's, you know, how do we actually turn liquidity into security? And how do we make that a productive, you know, source of capital or source of efficiency for the applications that are building on the chain itself?
Yeah, definitely. So I think when I first heard the pitch, proof of liquidity really resonated with me as someone that is actively in thinking and using DeFi. And at the time, you know, as you said, Eigenlayer was not really in the picture. But, you know, in today's world, I want to double click on what you just said. Like, how do you see proof of liquidity relative to how Ethereum is kind of shaping up with, you know, obviously proof of stake and, you know, a lot of these kind of derivative products to try to get at what you guys are probably doing more natively, which is just more capital efficiency and alignment between security and liquidity. But I want to dive deeper into that.
Yeah. No, it totally makes sense, man. And I think it's a good question because the devil's always in the details and so is the nuance, right? And I guess rule number one of CT/crypto in general is that people don't read. So the way that we think about it is that proof of liquidity in many ways is a variant of delegated proof of stake, but there's some pretty important differences. One is that, you know, it actually relies on, you know, what we have in a sort of a dual token. And it's actually a tri-token system for us specifically, because there's also a network stablecoin that's very low risk, et cetera. But for us, proof of liquidity really comes down to the interactions between two tokens, BGT, or the Bearer Governance Token, and Bearer, which is the gas token/liquid token of the network. The first thing to keep in mind is that BGT is a natively illiquid soul-bound token, which is to say that one cannot market buy it, one cannot just go purchase it on a DEX. They actually have to do the work or provide the value of providing liquidity to the ecosystem in order to earn BGT itself. So that in itself is like the basis for proof of liquidity, in that the staking token and the governance token of the network, BGT, can only be obtained via actually doing the work of providing liquidity. And I think that's part of like the social contract or the consensus that we want to enforce, which is to say, in order to reap the you know, the rewards of network governance or network staking, you have to first provide the value that we think is most essential to the network, i.e. liquidity, right? So to go more granularly, the way that this actually works on a network level is that BearChain has a set of, you know, 100 plus validators, and each of those validators have their own, you know, you can think of it as a gauge or a cutting board in the same way they're FRAX or curve gauges. And validators, when they win a block, are basically able to allocate their block rewards across the different pools on the network. So that starts with, you know, something as simple as the DEX, the Perps Vault, and the lending market that'll be live when the chain goes live. And validators can basically choose to forward or redirect their block rewards towards those different points on the network in the form of that BGT. And at the same time, users can choose to delegate their BGT that they've earned via providing liquidity in one of those venues to the validator, to a given validator, depending on how it's distributing its BGT. So for example, you could have a user who has a large, you know, position in the DEX, and they could choose to, you know, delegate the vast majority of the BGT that they earn towards a validator that's doing the same, and that is effectively pushing the vast majority of their block awards towards the DEX pools that they're LPing in. On the other hand, you could have a validator that's taking a much more, you know, index-like approach and is effectively, you know, pushing part of its block awards towards the perps vault and towards pool A on the DEX and pool B on the lending market, et cetera. And a user who might have a more diversified portfolio might actually choose to work with that validator. So, you know, the whole idea of proof of liquidity is that in order to earn the staking token, of the network and the governance token of the network, you have to first do the work of providing liquidity. And by voting with or staking with the validators that are, you know, effectively determining where emissions on the network go, you are able to, as a user, help control the flow of incentives and therefore ideally liquidity across the network. And at any point in time, one can take that BGT and one way burn it into Bera, the gas token. So you can never just go buy a bunch of Bera and turn it into BGT, but you can take the BGT that you've earned via providing liquidity on the network and turn it into Bera. So I think that's the most base implementation of it. There's definitely more nuance there in that, you know, protocols can work directly with validators to incentivize their own liquidity pools. And over time, you know, the part of proof liquidity that I think gets most exciting, and I think is a major deviation beyond what I've already described from proof of stake, is that over time, any smart contract on Bera chain can plug into proof of liquidity and can actually become an eligible destination for BGT emissions and generation. So you could have a, you know, Delta Neutral vault, you could have an NFT AMM like PseudoSwap, you could have anything that people are effectively depositing liquidity into, and in exchange for some portion of that application's value generation, whether that is fees, whether that is token emissions, et cetera, going towards the BGT stakers on the network, you can actually have the chain itself directing emissions and part of its block rewards, that BGT reward, towards that new application. And I think that's what gets really cool because, you know, I don't think there's an example to date, to my knowledge at least, of a proof of stake chain that can actually, you know, power the applications building on top of it, right? We've seen CSR type approaches that sort of, you know, give rebates of sorts to the largest gas consuming, you know, contracts on the network. But I don't think that's actually the chain's block rewards going towards the protocols that are being, you know, deemed as most important by its validators and users. And I think that's the social contract that gets very exciting over time and hopefully gives more and more applications a reason to actually build on Bera Chain uniquely, because they can turbocharge their capital efficiency, they can effectively enshrine themselves into the chain, and they can find a way to work with the validators to gain a mechanistic advantage in a manner where I don't think they could anywhere else.
Yeah. How is the allocation decided in terms of the BGT rewards?
Yeah. So it's entirely done by the validator set. So, you know, and I guess the way to think about it is that, you know, validators will have different amounts of BGT staked delegated to each of them. And each validator will also have its own customized distribution of how they wish to, you know, divide that BGT across the network, right? In terms of where they will forward those emissions. So what actually determines the, you know, rewards rates across the network or across all the pools being powered by proof of liquidity is the weighted average of each of those validators, right? So, you know, one validator might have 100,000 BGT staked to them, another might have 10, right? So obviously one will have much more weight than the other. But it's effectively the validator set and the user's distribution of their delegations that determines the network reward rates and the breakdown to BGT.
In that model, can you talk about who the validators are and could they have a misalignment of interests or incentives when it comes to allocating that BGT?
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, the validators on the chain will have, a few different profiles. On one hand, there'll be a number of your classic sort of most established validator groups. So think like your Figments and your Kilns and your Coinbase Clouds and all those types of groups who are just experienced node operators that can keep up with good network upgrades, all that kind of stuff. On the other hand, I'm sure that we'll have a number of investors that'll be looking to run their own nodes and folks that have, you know, previously been private participants in Bera Chain rounds. We also expect to see some of the largest LPs on the chain serving as validators at some point for those that are competent in running node operations. Because, you know, it actually very cleanly sort of satisfies that social contract that we discussed, right? If someone is going to be, you know, dropping $25 million into a stable pool, they're contributing a lot of value to the network. That should allow them to, you know, gain a pretty meaningful initial BGT stack. And they, as a validator, could also choose to do as much as possible to direct more towards their pools. We also do expect to see a few protocols running validators, which I think becomes really interesting. And opens up a little bit more of a competitive dynamic. So, for example, some of the ones coming out of the chain incubator, the Build-A-Bear program, we expect to see some of those guys running validators and some of the larger names that are coming over from other chains, which we can't exactly disclose as of yet. But it's definitely one way for those groups to have a little bit of like edge in the market. The thing that gets interesting is like, I think that the incentive marketplace that'll be built on top of the validators should allow for, the most efficient market to reign free. In that at any point in time, a new protocol will be able to effectively submit an offer or, bribe, I think like Votium style in a manner to the validator set. And, whichever validator chooses to pick that up, will A, be able to have a call option on that protocol in the form of its tokens, its fees, whatever it might be. While B, effectively being able to actually help power that protocol from an emissions and capital efficiency point of view. A lot of this goes towards, I think, the endpoint that I mentioned of really just getting the best protocols to build on the chain and actually getting the validator set to work closely with those groups such that we actually, I think, strive towards as meritocratic of a system as possible, right? If you're a validator and you're figuring out what you want to do with your block rewards, you can either choose to double down on the most classic, perhaps high yielding pools or high activity pools, or you could basically say, hey, there's this new protocol that I want to have exposure to and I want my delegates to have exposure to. Why don't I work with them and direct some portion of my rewards there? And when we think about ways that this could be exploited or effectively enforced in a manner that's negative, a lot of it does and will come down to governance and social contract. I do think that the nice part is, though, the governance here is very much people who have had to put skin in the game and people who have had to, do the work contributing to liquidity if they want, say over how it actually flows. So I'm sure that in practice, we'll definitely have events where people try to do, weird like mochi-like stuff. But I also do have belief, and I think we think a lot about the initial validator set selection and or delegation and ensuring that they're sort of responsible actors, with the network safety and long-term health as their priorities, which is, of course, why I mentioned some of the private investors, some of the protocols, et cetera. You want folks who care a lot about and who have a vested interest in the network, living for a very long time safely.
Yeah. And what are these emission curve look like?
So we've been joking about the bear chain halvenings in that, I can't say exact APYs, we do expect to have, meaningful inflation to start enough to really, give proof of liquidity a good amount of juice and allow those block rewards to flow well. And then to basically have a series of halvenings, first one after like a year and change, second one after another one, so on and so forth. With the idea of basically, driving inflation to the low single digits over time as sort of a maintenance rate.
Yeah. So I want to maybe focus a little bit on the journey to what you are now and the roadmap and how you, see the next year unfolding for you guys. But so timeline wise, just walk us through. So like the NFT conception, and then you start building a bear. How long did that take? You're building through the bear. You're building bear through the bear. So how was that? Where are you now? And what are the things, like what's in store for the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, for sure. There's a lot coming and there's a lot in the past, I suppose. So, we sort of did our, I don't think that fundraising is a milestone, but I do think it's something that ends up as being a little bit of an anchor point. So I'll discuss, with context of that as well. So, I'd say the idea fully found its wings, probably in like early 2022. The NFTs themselves were for the most part, like over the course of like mid 21 to like late 22 in terms of like those different collections coming out over time and the community growing and growing and sort of like, effectively snowballing a little bit. And then I think the whole idea of like bear chain, is something that we started like, basically joking with people about. And throwing around a little bit more seriously in like that early 22 timeframe. And actually for the longest time, the meme that we were just like doubling down on was we were just like, yeah, bear chain isn't real. Because we'd have a bunch of people, asking us if we were building a chain. We're like, no, there's no way the anonymous bears could build a chain. That's ridiculous. And we just thought it was kind of funny. It may have worked too well to an extent because we ended up with a whole bunch of folks actually thinking that bear chain wasn't real. And being like, oh, I thought it was just like a crypto Twitter meme. We're glad that we kind of proved that part wrong. We basically started building out the team on the engineering side in that like early 22 timeframe. Dev Bear, who leads all technical operations internally, spent the vast majority of his career at Apple, previously, you know, studied engineering at a top engineering school in Canada, and was, you know, building out the entire base plate for this. And I think our first major public release of that was Polaris, which is like sort of our open source implementation of EVM on Cosmos. It's currently under a BUSL license, but we plan to open source it over time. I just wanted to make sure that we, you know, we're relatively protected until the chain itself goes live, so that we don't have to deal with even more bear chain copycats than we have at the moment. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we basically announced our Series A / our larger fundraise in April of 23. We actually completed the majority of that while FTX was blowing up over the year before, mm-hmm. which was lots of fun. And I'm sure you remember that market fondly. And then, you know, I'd say our public code debut was with Polaris, was sort of in like that March, Q1 23 timeframe. And then after that, we really started more aggressively expanding the BD and growth team. For the longest time, it was sort of just myself and home from our team, spending time like talking to projects, cultivating the community a little bit, just trying to wear every hat possible. And we wanted to make sure that as we started thinking about international expansion, as we started thinking about sort of more formal, I'd say, breakdown within the growth team, whether that be DevRel functions, marketing functions, you know, validator relation functions, everything in between, that we hit that stride at the right time. And then, you know, we launched our testnet in January of this year. Has been pretty exciting. We did like a couple of small private testnets with, you know, some 50, 75 projects that wanted to build with us prior to that, in just like a very locked down, you know, password protected manner, towards, you know, sort of the end of last year. And then, you know, took the reins off a bit and decided to show the world what we've been cooking up earlier this year. So, you know, it's been a wild journey, and we've seen the team go from like, you know, three dudes like living together to like, you know, seven dudes in a house to now like close to 45 people, wow. with the entire engineering team in Toronto. And the growth and sort of like BD team that I spend more time on, pretty globally distributed. So there's folks in Korea, there's folks in, you know, mainland China, there's folks in India, there's folks in Dubai. There's a decent contingent in like New York and New Jersey. And then of course there's a decent Toronto presence as well, which is where we're sort of all headquartered. So we've just been expanding all over the place, and are looking towards our mainnet within the next few months. So within the next 6 to 12 months, we should see, you know, the token live. We should see Bearchain alive and kicking. We should probably see the next batch of projects out of the Build-A-Bear incubator as well, mm-hmm. Which we've been seeing a ton of inbound for more recently. And I hope to see just like a very buzzing, lively, real ecosystem. I think that like, you know, what's always been most exciting to me and where I spend as much time as possible is just thinking about the 0-to-1 stuff that can exist on Bearchain, or that Bearchain is uniquely sort of built to serve, and can really just, you know, how we can help enable that next group of builders who could go anywhere, but see a real fit here, whether that be user base, whether that be culture, whether that be mechanism design. And I'm excited to start seeing, you know, more and more of those groups sort of come out of stealth, announce their rounds, announce that they'll be launching first on Bearchain, all that kind of stuff. Because I think that's something we've talked about a whole bunch internally, is like, you know, what our approach is to the whole like next million / next billion users thing is. And I think while it has been a bit of a meme to date, honestly, I do think that there's a number of paths forward there. I think that on one hand, you need these projects that are like GMX or like Frontech, they're like that are like DFK, that actually have a chance of being like a vacuum for new people net into an ecosystem. And I think you also need a really healthy degree of like, you know, user like chain abstraction, UX improvements, account abstraction type stuff that makes it friendly and usable for a new person. And ultimately, if we model a chain as the sum of all the applications that are living on top of it, in the same way as like, you know, I think you think about an operating system, whether that's like Android or iOS, you don't necessarily think to no end about the operating system. You think about, you know, how it improves your quality of life and the apps you can uniquely use on one of those operating systems. We want to make sure that the apps that are building things that people actually want to use are living on Bearchain, and that we are that home or that sandbox for people building cool, new, interesting things, both culturally and mechanistically. So I think that's like the real end goal for the next 6 to 12 months. How do we have all the new heavy hitters building cool new stuff on Bear?
And what's the pitch to... So you mentioned there's a lot of like first-time builders on Bear. But yeah. The pitch to protocols that are in another ecosystem, what is the pitch to them?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's a mixture there, right? On one hand, there's this idea of like, okay, you know, if you guys want to, you know, turbocharge your capital efficiency, if you want to access a bunch of DeFi users who are actually pretty engaged and have actively tried new products, whether that's maxing out sort of the, you know, every new options platform or every new NFTFi platform, or just generally have meaningful on-chain net worths from every piece of data that, that one can find, you know, there's a there's actually like a captive audience. There's users, there's liquidity. And then on the other hand, it's actually showing them not even just the first-time application builders, but the experienced application builders that will be launching new applications for the first time on Barrachain and how they could plug into some of those ones. And effectively, the synergies are like the kingmaker trades that could uniquely exist for some of the apps that are building on Barra with bringing other people over. So, you know, for example, like there's the guys at Smiley Finance, who I'm fans of. They're, you know, part of the Italian options mafia that builds really cool products, but a lot of people, you know, it goes over their heads or it's just under the hood. And, you know, a lot of proof of liquidity will revolve around the DEX or revolve around products that will have some degree of intermittent loss, you know, for basically, you know, the people who are involved there, right? For people who are involved there. And these guys build actually like really cool, like yield hedging products that can allow people to actually hedge their IL, which could like pair super nicely with even the native DEX or a number of the other applications building on top of the chain, right? So I think that being able to show people that there are some very unique and interesting, you know, sum of the parts is greater than the whole opportunities here has been a great pitch to builders. And also like a vibrant and real ecosystem. And I think that's become like a bit of like a meme as well over time, as people are just like, oh yes, like look at my ecosystem. Look at my like, you know, 10 Velodrome forks and like 3 Uni forks and like 2 Aave forks. And I think that the nice part has been that when builders look under the hood here, they see A, like, you know, there's the vast majority of quality of life services that they've been used to on other chains, whether that's just ease of deployment of code and EVM equivalents, or on the other hand, you know, account abstraction, on-ramps, you know, different wallet accesses, sort of like everything in between there. And they have just access to an ecosystem that has like people building new stuff that they haven't seen before. And I think builders really do appreciate that because I think they're also a little bit tired of like the grant and like, you know, chain of the day rotation meta.
Yeah, yeah. So much of the pitch that I hear from teams is, look, we want to plug into Ethereum because that's where the users and the liquidity exists. From your standpoint, how important is that? Or, yeah, how important is that for you?
No, totally. I think that, and, you know, it's an interesting question because it makes me think of another one that we've discussed a lot. I personally do not necessarily ascribe to the belief around an Ethereum killer at the moment. I think there's a world where, I think there's a world down the road where you have, you know, Ethereum killers that perhaps with a massive amount of social tide changing and buy-in from major, major institutions, your Googles, your Apples, whatever it is, that actually have the firepower and the distribution to achieve that, could will into existence. But I actually think that, you know, the majority of chains right now are best positions as Ethereum adjacent, right? And having access to a lot of ETH like resources, but not necessarily deviating from the ecosystem itself. And I think I view us very similarly. Like, I'd love to see us right up there beside ETH in terms of, you know, a chain that has a similar set of resources, perhaps one day a greater and or a similar amount of capital and a great, you know, dev community and user community. But I think that it's foolish to assume that that's, you know, feasible out the gates. What I do think is entirely possible is to build an ecosystem that allows you to have the access of, you know, the capital, the users, the liquidity from ETH. And that's easily enabled by different bridging solutions, by different sort of like middleware solutions. So for example, for us, you know, we'll have layer zero there day one. We expect to have outposts for liquidity acquisition on a number of different chains for a number of the applications that will be living natively on Barrachain, such that we can actually, you know, be a little bit more like as much of a meme as it is, like ETH aligned or like ETH adjacent, right? And do our best to have access to those resources without necessarily living solely on Ethereum.
Yeah.
So I think we think about it like a lot more in terms of ETH proximity as opposed to necessarily one-to-one on ETH. Mm-hmm.
A lot of the challenges historically has been that liquidity is very fickle and is a hot ball of money that is constantly trying to optimize. How do you think about that and, you know, in proof of liquidity, because the incentives are kind of perhaps more aligned and enshrined, does that create more stickiness to liquidity, or do you foresee, you know, the same dynamic where people are just trying to optimize and chase kind of better yielding opportunities?
Yeah, I think it determines, it's determined a lot by the profile of user that we end up attracting at the end of the day. I think that in all cases, liquidity is always mercenary. And I think it's rational for liquidity to be mercenary, right? I think most people are not necessarily on-chain to change the world. I think they're on-chain to make a buck, which, you know, I can respect. And I think that when we model that, the way that we thought a lot about Bearchain is how do you give people the greatest amount of utility and the greatest amount of flexibility with shared liquidity, right? Like, how do you have your stake in ETH2 without creating, you know, threatening situations from a safety or leverage point of view, right? You know, so for example, we often end up with a question of like, you know, what happens if liquidity is pulled from Bearchain, right? In like relative mass, right? Does that cause a death spiral? Does Bearchain blow up? And it's actually, you know, I understand why people would ask that because it is, of course, proof of liquidity. But that is just, you know, a name for it. At the end of the day, you know, the chain doesn't blow up if people, you know, lose emissions, or sorry, if people take out their liquidity. Rather, it just means that emissions are more concentrated to the group of people that remains, right?
There's presumably market equilibrium where that increases the APY, attracts new users.
Exactly. And there's other nuance there around how, you know, BGT itself accrues fees from the network's operation. So at some point, it's actually sort of more EV positive, theoretically, for a user to hold that BGT that's accruing yield over time than to just, you know, sell into bear, withdraw their liquidity, et cetera. But that's a whole different rabbit hole. I think that for us, the thing that's very interesting is that I believe that we give users more flexibility in terms of what they can actually do with their staked or LP'd capital than anywhere else, right? So, you know, they don't have to change their user behavior in LPing in these different applications, especially as more and more end up being powered by proof of liquidity over time. They rather just end up having their emissions boosted, you know, by the chain's emissions itself and actually then get to choose what to do with their BGT. And then they can choose to either use that to, you know, basically delegate to validators that are being incentivized by their applications and use that to gain call options on, you know, cool, interesting new dApps. Mm-hmm. Or they can just use that to, you know, boost their own yields, or they can use that to just earn fees, right? I think what I'm getting at is proof of liquidity is meant to make liquidity as sticky as possible by boosting the yields in some manner, but on the other hand, by actually just giving users more optionality in terms of what they can do without sacrificing their initial desired position and changing their market behavior.
Yeah. I guess to compare it, Blast seems like closest to proof of liquidity with the nuance, I'll add, and you correct me, that for instance, now people deposit in Blast earning Blast points. Now that apps have launched, there are multipliers. If you're using the apps, you earn app points, you also get Blast points if you're using and encourages usage of these apps. Mm-hmm. But I guess it's not at the mechanism level that is more, I mean, I guess the question really is, how do you think about Blast in the context of proof of liquidity?
Yeah, I think that both groups have a focus on capital efficiency in some manner, in terms of like, you know, the underlying rebasing on Blast and in terms of the point/multiplier systems. I think that what's different here and the way that we think a lot about proof of liquidity is how those value flows are aligned, right? You know, there's no single centralized actor. There's no group that's saying, hey, this app gets more, you know, emissions than that app. There's only effectively what the validators and what the users on the chain who've contributed liquidity get to say. So I think that the whole idea of an application being able to, you know, launch on Parachain and then actually plug into POL and have the network dictate its outcomes to some extent, you know, is pretty different from what we see there, in that you effectively have the users in control of where the applications end up incentive wise. And I think that that's like really important to actually focus on users and how to make their experience as good as possible. But I do think that both groups have a focus on, you know, increasing capital efficiency in some manner.
Yeah. So the validators, and in a scenario where there's one validator, I don't know if this is possible, but one validator has a disproportionate share of the governance power.
Yep.
How do you, are you A, concerned about that being a kind of an attack vector, or a, or are there mechanisms in place to, you know, make governance less of a kind of surface area, if you will, from a,
No, it's a great question. And that is perhaps like the biggest potential threat to Bearchain as a whole. And that's actually part of why, you know, one of the first projects that came out of Build-A-Bearer is called Infrared. And it's effectively, you know, a combination of a few different things, but on one hand, an LST, on the other hand, a governance aggregator, and on sort of the final hand, like a block building layer over time in sort of an MEV operation context, such that, you know, proof of liquidity has pretty interesting incentives in place from a block ordering point of view, because these validators are each incentivizing different pools, some of which they might be depositing into as well, right? And you actually want to ensure that that's done in a relatively, you know, neutral and censorship resistant way over time, but also that as a validator, you're building the most effective blocks possible, right? And ordering transactions in a manner that is, you know, not threatening to the network, but also good for you financially if you're running an MEV operation, right?
Right.
So part of what we wanted to do by working with the Infrared guys, who are, you know, good friends of the team, is ensuring that if there was to ever be an actor that had a meaningful amount of network control, that they were very much, you know, I think on side incentivized, you know, non-malicious actors, right? And that's why, you know, their system involves basically people being able to deposit into the various, you know, POL venues through Infrared and receiving IBGT, a liquid staking token derivative of BGT over time, that they can then choose to, you know, use in their on-chain interactions as they should wish. So in short, I wouldn't say that there's a hard-coded technical condition. And, you know, sadly, actually, the vast majority of Cosmos chains at the moment can be taken over by like their top 3 to 5 validators, right? And, you know, always like to emphasize like Bearchain is very EVM on the top. But at the validator logic level, it's Tendermint consensus. There's Cosmos under the hood, even though the vast majority of users wouldn't be able to tell that. But the second thing is that, like, from a network incentives point of view, I'd say that, you know, Bearchain is very much set up to to incentivize stake decentralization, right? Because you have each of these validators with their different incentives. And in many cases, you'll have some of these protocols running their own validators as well. And I think that what that actually does is it creates a number of different incentive schemes, or, you know, game theory paths, if you will, for users to subscribe to when they're choosing what to actually do with their tokens, right? So I think it's very unlikely that we find a situation where between the incentives markets and the inherent incentives of different validators that we actually end up in a scenario where we just have one behemoth-like figure in the network.
Yeah. No, I agree. And the reason I ask is because historically there is this tendency for validators to kind of cluster.
Of course.
Increasingly Lido. And then you look at, you know, in Cosmos, you look at all some of the app chains. There's like
exactly
concentration is high and tends to be higher over time.
You've got it. Yeah. And our goal is very much like, I think we, as a chain, like ethos wise, we care a lot about maintaining competition. I think that if you have a non-competitive ecosystem, it blows up over time. And I think that we believe that should ascribe to the validator marketplace as well, right? And that's why, you know, having these different protocols figure out their effectively, like, you know, their bribe marketplace or matchmaking system allows for these different validators to have a leg up in terms of how they want to acquire users, delegates, stake, etc.
All right, I mentioned them in the pre-roll. Now I'm going to bring them up again. It's Arbitrum. Santi and I are really fed up with these high fees, and we're really excited to have teamed up with Arbitrum for the next couple of months on Empire. As the leading Ethereum scaling solution, Arbitrum now powers hundreds of decentralized apps across DeFi, perps, NFTs, gaming, and a whole lot more. The team has showed us everything in the ecosystem, both now and what's to come, and we're really, really excited about it. Arbitrum allows both daily users and developers to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. The way the team got me excited was through portal.arbitrum.io. So my call to action to you is to get started by visiting portal.arbitrum.io. Go experience on-chain like it was meant to be. For a lot of Empire listeners, your crypto is not just another number on a screen. It's part of your future. I know Santi and myself feel that way. Our security sponsor of this episode, Harpy, takes this responsibility seriously and is the only wallet security tool that shields users from both on-chain threats and sneaky off-chain signature attacks. If you've ever been in that situation where you're moving quickly, you approve something on-chain, you realize that the address might be a dubious address, or you're really hoping that you could take that back, Harpy has you covered. Harpy can redirect your assets to your self-custody vault, ensuring they remain completely under your control, safe and sound. With Harpy's always-on monitoring, you're not just detecting threats, you're actively blocking and recovering compromised assets from malicious transactions before they can even confirm on-chain. Harpy is the only wallet security solution that protected 100% of its users from attacks like the Ledger one in Q4, which was an off-chain signature attack. So if you're serious about protecting your crypto investments, it's time to make the switch. Secure your wallet for free at harpy.io/empire. That's Harpy, harpy.io/empire. If you want it to be even easier, just click the link in the show notes. This episode is brought to you by Supra, an Oracle provider across over 50 different blockchains. Whether it's critical price levels or liquidation triggers, beat your competition to the punch with Supra. It's as good as having the first mover advantage on every price update. Supra offers fast oracles and DVRF free for 12 months at supra.com/blockworks for a limited time only. So you're going to want to bank on this 12-month free offer as soon as possible. And if you're just listening and you know any builders, you can earn $1,500. That's $1,500 that you can go throw into Bonk or Whiff or whatever meme coin you like by letting them know about this deal. They can get fast oracles today free for 12 months, and you get $1,500 for the referral. You can visit supra.com/blockworks to learn more. Go check them out. Tell them Santi sent you. Tell them Jason sent you. We got you back. Thanks, Supra, for sponsoring.
We've talked a lot about proof of liquidity, the mechanism. We've talked a little bit about the type of applications. I guess anything else that you'd like to focus on those things before we kind of transition more to the roadmap and kind of the things you're mostly excited about?
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd add is, like, one thing that we think about a lot, and I think that informs, like, our building ethos, if you will, is the idea of, like, where value flows from and where it should flow to. And I think that's probably, like, the biggest thing that led us to a lot of the changes or conclusions that we made to proof of liquidity over time. In that, you know, I think in a traditional proof of stake chain, you tend to see a lot of value accrue at the validator level, right? And that's great. Validators are super important in keeping the network alive and, you know, making sure that things are safe and that the chain does not go down or halt. Sometimes there's a bullish halt, but most cases less so, right? I think that in proof of liquidity, the whole idea is that we're in service of the protocols and the users themselves. And that's probably the part that I would really try to nail home. Because while we do love our validators, and we do think that they have actually unprecedented economic control and ability to gain economic upside in bearer chain, what we do care about a ton is the users that are actually on the chain itself and the protocols that are actually bringing in new users. Like, we model a chain like ours very much as like a B2B to C function, right? In that, you know, I don't think that people will want to use Bearer Chain just because it's Bearer Chain. Like, I think that's cool, and I'd love it if just, you know, the vibes, the culture, the community did it, but people want to use it because of what is on Bearer Chain, right? And I think that by empowering the protocols to an extent that we haven't seen before, and in turn, letting the users decide which protocols really are empowered and which ones win, I think we create the first system that, as I see it, has value flows appropriately aligned, right? It's not just going to the miners. It's not just going to the validators. It's going to them in whatever way they want, especially with tons of upside to them if they work with the best protocols that are bringing new users into the chain. And I think that that's just, like, the most exciting, like, philosophy that I've seen around the building side.
Historically, that's been probably the biggest point of tension in Ethereum, right? You see time and time again, from DYDX to so many people within the Ethereum camp that ended up going to, as you say, you know, start their own ETH killers. And it really boils down to this concentration of rewards to a particular group, whereas this presumably locks in and everyone shares in a more equitable manner, creates more consumer preference, creates more line flows, as you say. So yeah, it'll be interesting to observe for sure. I guess sometimes like when you, I want to talk about scalability fees and how that might compare to Solana, to an ETH L2, and particularly on the user side, you know, do you have a view on the, where 100%. You guys kind of place on that map?
For sure. For sure. And you know, that's one of the things that we think about the most, especially because like, you know, one of the biggest issues that we had with our testnet was we were, you know, thrilled to see the amount of user inflow. But we did not expect like a million users, you know, I will say the word users with air quotes here, right? Like it's definitely 50%+ bots from the data that we've seen. Right. We'll take it over like the standard of like 80%+ bots, but you know, still, we didn't expect the degree of traffic that we saw. And that actually caused us to run into some fundamental scaling issues that haven't actually been seen since like Terra blew up in a Cosmos chain, which is like, you know, a champagne problem in some ways, a problem in other ways. Right. So we've actually been spending a little while working on upgrades to the chain itself and its architecture that moves closer to, you know, a beacon chain like structure that actually, you know, resembles a lot more like ETH mainnet, which we just thought is really funny at the end of the day. But something that allows us to maintain a ton of users without having as much of a dependency on the Cosmos mempool or the Comet mempool, I should say, which has been a subject of great contention or debate, and every now and then a major blocker for folks, including ourselves. So by moving, you know, the execution into the EVM and making our lives a little bit easier there, we should A, unlock a fair bit more performance in terms of, you know, concurrent users and traffic on one hand. And on the other hand, we actually end up with a chain structure that, you know, is even more interoperable or even easier for users to build around than the current version of Polaris. So Polaris has already, you know, been demonstrated to be pretty compatible across the stack for different rollups. So if someone wants to deploy an OP stack rollup to Polaris, we've done this in the past with the guys at Celestia. And just for explicit context, Polaris is effectively like our version of EVM on Cosmos. It's the base plate that Bearchain is built upon. So if you think about it as a stack, you know, you have the Cosmos logic underneath, you have like the Polaris EVM, and then you basically have like the POL logic, you know, basically wrapped on top of that or into the validator set for Bearchain itself to work. And what we basically found over time is that we can build a solution that should have, you know, fairly low fees. I think there's a good amount of control over that. I don't think that we'll shoot for quite as low fee-wise as Solana, but I think that somewhere in like the, you know, the AVAX and or Polygon proof of stake type of like, you know, fee layer is probably where we end up by. While at the same time, you know, maintaining our block times as low as possible, looking sort of the 1 to 2 second range, and ideally driving those down more and more over time, while being able to support lots of different rollups for application-specific use cases. Mm-hmm. So we're starting to see the first couple of rollups pop up already on Bera. There's Shogun, which should be like super cool. Yeah. In 10 centric, you know, yeah, like, and I love the product, and B, I think it's very interesting from a Bera point of view, and that the whole idea is, you know, trade any asset from any chain in like a coincidence of wants plus, you know, JIT, just-in-time LP vaults in parallel while settling it on Bera chain. So, you know, you just have like your mothership for trading of sorts, while ideally passing through a network that should have some of the deepest liquidity flows on chain. And then we already have other groups who are looking to build, you know, structured product chains, gaming chains, a couple of consumer ideas, everything in between. So
this I think is using, when you say that, it's using Polaris.
Yeah, you've got, so they would either, some of them will want to use Polaris itself as a roll up to Bearchain. Other groups want to use like OP stack. I think those have been the two most like popular options to date in terms of actually, you know, building a roll up to Bearchain.
And when someone builds a roll up on Bera, how does that fee sharing or like governance sharing happen? Is it basically the same? If they're plugging in, the rewards can be routed to them?
And that's exactly what we're sort of like, you know, architecting right now. But ideally, yes. And what we think is like extremely interesting is sort of like, you know, apps, you know, basically app chain specific rollups, right? Rolling up to Bearchain and being eligible for BGT distributions and or, you know, BGT incorporation via POL in the same way that any application living on Bearchain might be, right? Because, you know, they can have their super clean mempool, they can capture their own MEV from the application and the users on the chain, and they can perhaps, you know, plug into POL in exchange for some portion of trading fees or sequencer fees or whatever it is that might make most sense.
Yeah.
So I think that's like one of the very, you know, I think the the beauty of POL is like the degree of customizability that we can get, in that, you know, an application really has to exchange value for liquidity, but that value can take so many different forms. It could be commissions from an NFT marketplace. It could be, you know, fees from a SocialFi app. Like, I think that that can be, you know, super malleable. And it actually just, you know, basically in Denver, I had to give a chat at both Modular Day and Liquidity Day at the same time. Okay. So I decided to write a deck about modular liquidity.
I was literally just thinking that. Like, reminds me so much of modularity, but like modular liquidity, I like it.
Exactly, right? And I'm like, listen, this is kind of a meme, but there's actually an element of truth here in that proof of liquidity itself makes, you know, block rewards and incentives, you know, incredibly modular from a liquidity standpoint in terms of where it goes across the chain, where they can be distributed, what they're distributed in exchange for, everything in between, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't want to, you know, Jack for what it's vibe there.
Yeah. For what it's worth, I like the customization term better.
Exactly.
It's just more precise, I think. And, you know, looking ahead, you know, in a world where you have these rollups using Polaris, we have native apps like also plugging into proof of liquidity. Is it fair to assume that in the early days, most of the reward will be derived from the high emissions from BGT? Over time, success probably looks like that shifts from governance rewards to fees from apps. In a world where you have a ton of a thriving app ecosystem across different applications, the validators are probably earning, I don't know, maybe 80-20 starts with BGT, and then that shifts pretty on the app side more.
Exactly.
And that... Right. That's pretty powerful too.
Exactly. Right. Like what we think about is like, what is something that can actually be sustainable for a meaningful time frame? And also like culturally enforces the right ideals, right? And I think that that's like a point that sometimes goes underrated. Like a chain's culture, or like what they embody, like from an ecosystem, a building, whatever point of view, is often like tough to exactly put a nose on, right? You think of BSC as like a wild casino. You think of like, you know, Optimism as a lot of like pretty like OG ETH aligned folks. You think of Arbitrum as like a home for pretty cool DeFi stuff, right? And like Base is starting to get in the mix there as well. I think that what we want to enforce both like mechanistically and culturally is this idea that like, if people build cool stuff here, they will win, right? And I very much think that that's, you know, that's embedded within the validator logic and the incentive systems within the chain.
On the MEV side of things and the validation side of things, like if a validator has a pretty big stake, say that a validator like Figment, right? They have a fund that is also investing in projects. So they've been, say that Figment Capital invests in a bunch of projects like Shogun or whatever. And then is there like a potential like conflict of interest where like a validator has a disproportionate say on like block ordering or MEV if they like want to really just prioritize one app versus another, and then that is in conflict with another validator group? Like, does that problem make sense? Like,
I get what you mean to an extent. I think that like, again, like, you know, basically a validator will win more blocks if it has more BGT with it, right? And presumably the validators that have the most BGT will be the ones that, you know, are directing emissions towards the pools that are most used across the network, right? So I do think that the free market to some extent helps resolve that problem in terms of, you know, the incentives will flow towards the pools that are most productive. But I also do think it's entirely possible and likely that, you know, some of these, you know, groups, and to be clear, there won't be many, like we're thinking like single digits in each of them, will be able to effectively, you know, prioritize their own applications and their own, you know, vested interests, right? In the same way that any LP validator who is also like a liquid fund may likely have like a meaningful amount of capital on chain and be like, cool, you know, I'm going to, you know, prioritize my transaction execution first.
Yeah.
Right? So I think I think both are feasible, but I also think that with the right checks and balances, neither end up being, you know, spirally problems.
Yeah. It's, I like the sort of the market takes care of it, of these
exactly
things.
Exactly. And like, look, I think
more
that like
customization,
exactly, and I think that like sometimes just talk, I think sometimes like the space errs in one of two directions to a fault. It's either super laissez-faire, like, trust me, bro, decentralized governance will figure everything out. And then you end up with Cosmos, right? On the other hand, sometimes it's way too much like, no, we need to be, you know, everything hands-on, like there's no room for flexibility whatsoever. And then I think you end up with a centralized system. And I don't think either of those outcomes are ideal. I think what we're trying to go for is like, you know, a happy medium where there is some social governance, there's some expectation of how people are to behave. But it's not to the point where it's like, okay, cool, you do something bad and you get booted, right? I think that's what slashing and everything in between is meant for.
Yeah. No, definitely. What are the things that are you're going to be paying most attention to now that you're kind of closer to mainnet? You know, oftentimes I think about the evolution of a network like Ethereum and then also Solana now to some extent, where a lot of times like you set certain parameters, fees in particular is what I'm thinking about, that you just, it's hard to model out and predict. And over time they've had to revisit, like Ethereum went through number iterations and most importantly EIP 1559. Solana is probably going to have to do something similar. Is there something in your mind that it's kind of like a known unknown that you're going to have to just over time figure out through governance? Another perhaps way of asking the question is like, what are the biggest risks that you see?
Yeah, yeah.
But I like better kind of known unknowns because risks sometimes.
For sure. Yeah. I think that like, you know, so to start like from a scaling / like fee point of view, I think there's a couple things that keep me up at night. One is, you know, what happens if the validator set grows to some extent beyond part of our control? As in, if enough folks just via providing a ton of liquidity, whatever it is, end up with a large enough delegation, or effectively a large enough BGT stack, that the active set ends up expanding to the point where, you know, block times are no longer palatable, right? And you just end up with like fucking 10-second blocks or something, right? And then you feel like you're on ETH mainnet. I think a lot of people like, yeah, I think a lot of people don't necessarily care about the actual block time. Like, there's actually just a whole bunch more nuance in terms of like gas per second and like what the feel is what I think people care about. They want to feel like you know, they hit a transaction, and even if it's like a soft confirmation soul style, right, that it went through, where they're like, they're probably good, right? I think that's what the vast majority of users think about. I think, you know, when you think about quant trading groups and, you know, large liquid funds, everything in between, you know, there's more nuance there for sure. But I think that's one of the things that we give some time of day to. Not something that we worry about a ton. The fee side, as mentioned, you know, we will have like an EIP 1559 type system like implemented as well. So like gas will be burned when it's used on parachain. So, you know, that should make our lives a little bit easier there. But I'd say that since we aren't thinking of ourselves either as like a, you know, the lowest fee chain, right? I don't think that that's necessarily our core focus, but also one that is relatively malleable over time from a governance point of view. One thing that I do think is kind of cool and an idea that we've been toying with, but it's probably just a little bit early for implementation for us, is what some of these localized fee markets could look like. Because I do think that there's promise there. And I think that like the idea itself like makes sense. From an implementation point of view, that's just probably likely more one of where, you know, devil's in the details, right? And then I think beyond that, the biggest practical thing that keeps me up at night is, you know, what happens if we just do not amass a ton of liquidity, and what happens if proof of liquidity does not lead to people being as sticky as we'd like them to be, right? I think it's super easy to model the world all like wag me and like trust me, I'll turn on the gates and then, you know, the billions will flood in. But I also think it's very important to be pragmatic or, you know, internally a little bit of a fodder as well in order to ensure max performance, right? So that's why we think a lot about it in a very, you know, non-laissez-faire manner. We think about it in terms of, you know, how do we talk to people who actively want to use the chain? How do we talk to groups that want to deploy, you know, idle liquidity? How do we talk to different groups that actually want to move their TVL over from other chains, whether that be their treasury, their vaults, whatever it might be, right? And you know, do everything we can to stack the pads to have a strong advantage rolling into launch, such that, you know, we have the stage set correctly for success in the long run. So BGT is generating lots of fees. validators are starting to work with protocols, new ones are being launched and working with other groups on the chain, everything in between. So I think that's actually the part that, like, you know, that's the biggest thing that keeps me up at night, in other words.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you been opinionated in the type of applications in sort of Bear, you mentioned Bearapalooza?
yeah, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say we've been opinionated in it, in as much as I think the applications building on the chain represent some of the team members' different interests and sort of like what we feel like we can like add outsized value in, right? And also what the chain is most optimized to support. So, for example, I don't necessarily think that from a liquidity or like capital efficiency point of view, that's always a top priority for games. But at the same time, I do think that they care a lot about like a cash incentive, like a cost insensitive and like active and engaged user base, right? So Papa from our team takes points on a lot of our gaming initiatives and whether there are projects that are building, you know, building games on chain or infrastructure and bringing, you know, five figures or eight figures of users, they have one reason to care about what we're doing, right? On the other hand, you know, myself, Sammy, you know, Yogi, who was part of, you know, some of the first DeFi protocols to ever exist, you know, we definitely err more towards DeFi and are like, cool, like a lot of these applications will fit really well into proof of liquidity. Then there's actually our roots as an NFT project, right? So we have both a bunch of folks who want to be like, hey, how do I go and build like NFT perps? How do I build a cool new marketplace with liquid backings? You know, how do I build like the next gen of like NFT production and or financialization permits? So I guess to answer the question most succinctly, we definitely have a leaning in that I think that we are T-shaped with a focus on DeFi, just given the structure of the chain. But I very much think that we do not self-select out because you end up with folks building cool stuff in RWAs, in SocialFi, in gaming, in NFTFi, everything in between.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Timeline-wise, and I know you may not want to commit to it, but just rough timeline, and I don't want your engineers to kill you either.
Of course.
Taking it, but you know, you've had mainnet, you've had some success there, a lot of interest. When mainnet?
Yeah. So you know, Tesla's been good to us. I think that we're looking at mainnet, you know, sometime in Q2, Q3. So it's really not that far out now. You know, of course, there's always a little bit of like logistical stuff that we'll need to handle. So, you know, finishing locking down our market maker selections and all that kind of stuff, and talking with some of our lovely friends at big exchanges and all that kind of stuff. But I think for the last little while, we just wanted to make sure that product and scalability was in the best place possible before, you know, hitting the road. I think the last thing that we want to do is ship something that we aren't proud of, or ship something that we don't think will, you know, very easily stand the test of time. And I'm pretty excited about a lot of the recent progress that's been made, because I do think that very much leaves us in a state where we can think to ourselves like, yeah, like this thing's going to run for 10, 20, whatever years, and it'll sustain in the future.
Yeah. I think it begins and ends, as you said, with you have to believe that and have conviction that there is a very thriving applications being built that support the fee mechanism, like, because that drives everything.
It's
so obvious, but somehow it can get lost when with other things, but it's always been clear for I'm curious, I always like to kind of end these discussions with, you know, as someone that, you know, you built Bear through the Bear, you've been involved in crypto for a long time. What has surprised you the most? And I think it's interesting to set the stage, because you built it not only at the time where like there's just so many L2s, there's so many competing, you know, EV like Ethereum killers.
Yeah.
And here you are building something new through a bear market. And I'm curious, like, what has surprised you the most in this journey?
Yeah, that's an interesting one. I think the biggest thing that has surprised me, probably two things. One is that it's very easy, I think, when you're starting out, you know, building in a new space that isn't super, super familiar from like a builder point of view, right? It's easy to think like, okay, there's some preordained playbook. There is a set of rules that I have to follow that leads to a win condition, right? Like I check this box, and I'm good. And I think that that's what we believed for some portion of time. It's like, okay, cool. Like, you know, AVAX did this, or Harmony did this, or Near did this, or, you know, Arbitrum did this, that, therefore this is what we have to do. And then I think that, like, as you meet your heroes, or as you talk to on a relatively raw level with a lot of these folks, it's the same thing that I think anyone learns, like, you know, as they grow up, or as you build your first company, et cetera. And like, for context, Papa and I had both built companies in the other side of the spectrum in like healthcare before this. So we definitely weren't unfamiliar with the feeling, but we thought that there was a much more established playbook, I want to say, in crypto. And I think quickly realized that, you know, it's much less deterministic, and rather it's actually one of the interesting fields where leaning into the degree of insanity or the lack of seriousness can be a massive source of edge if done correctly. So I think that, you know, that was massively surprising. And I think that the other thing that was somewhat surprising was just how mercenary and how low the bar can be at times, right? Like, I think that when you have a new industry in a relatively nascent space like crypto, you do two things. You attract the best of people and you attract the worst of people. Totally. Right? Like you get the folks who are like, hey, I want to come and fix this and make it better. And you get the folks who are like, yo, this thing's fucked. Let me extract as much value as possible and then get out, right? So I've met, you know, some of my favorite people working in the space, but I've also met some people who have, you know, just inexcusable shit to your behavior that in Web 2 would just get you like burned for life. You know what I mean? And I'm sure you've seen this too, having been in it for a while and having, you know, shared a somewhat similar background of healthcare, yeah, crypto, et cetera, right? So I think that, That was a little bit of like a black pill for me. Yeah. And sorry, I think like one last thing, and this is probably the taboo point, is I really truly believe, and I don't necessarily ascribe to this camp as a caveat, but I really truly believe that the vast majority of the participants do not care about the tech right now, no. For better or for worse, right?
I agree.
I think that like is also shocking in a manner, coming from a field that is very like empirically driven, very like rigor based, very like, you know, you spend 10 years in a lab to spin out something to try to get into some mice or something, right? And then you're like, wait, like no one cares about what's happening tech wise right now. All they care about is what people think is happening tech wise right now. And that's a tough pill to swallow, especially if you're somewhat idealist, right? So I think that we've very much tried to do our best to you know, responsibly play the game in terms of narratives, building, et cetera, while building tech that we think can really have massive edge. But it's really interesting to think about how it's all narratives and barbells all the way down.
Yeah. I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, I think if I were a builder, and when I talk to builders, I think you just assume that it's going to be mercenary. Like the beauty of crypto, which is also a bit of a curse, is that it assumes that everyone will act in their best interest.
Totally.
And I think when oftentimes people lean on the more idealistic side, and that's where I think problems start to emerge.
Yeah.
And so I think you just assume that the worst, because if the system works under that type of stress, then you really are setting yourself up for success.
You've got it.
And I think that should be kind of the operating assumption. But you're right. I mean, it can be hard.
No, and like, look, not to be
you're in the Discord and people are bitching at you and screaming at you. And
of course, I guess
the best way I've heard it's not recently. We're talking about, and someone said it. Look, at least they care. Whether it's they're screaming, so they're really passionate. So you're doing something right. Like, it's like, okay.
Well, you know, it brings a couple things to mind that we say a lot internally, right? The opposite of like of love isn't necessarily hate. It's apathy, right? It's just not caring, right? 100%. And then the other thing that's been really interesting to see, especially building anonymously, which I think has been a massive edge for us in some ways, even though it might be perceived as otherwise in others, has been that, like, you know, something that Papa said to me once and kind of stuck with me, and we say it a lot internally again now too, is that, you know, we tend to judge ourselves by our intentions and others by their actions, right? And I think that the interesting thing about the crypto space, with as many anon characters, as many people who are just abstracted in some manner, is that there is perhaps the greatest like playground for judging people based on their actions and what they do, and not just what they say they're going to do. And I think that's one of the things that I've appreciated a lot about the space. every now and then, like, you know, sucks and people just do bad things. But every now and then you can just, you know, be incredibly pleasantly surprised by OX water bottle kind of thing.
Amen. I mean, don't send me a resume. Don't tell me what you think. Show me your on-chain activity.
Exactly. Exactly. You know? Show me your wallet.
Yeah. It's been a real treat. I think this discussion, even as an investor, has been a great catch up because I've appreciated so much what you guys are building and excited to see the kind of applications that are being built. And I think it does lend itself to I'm really more excited about the kind of zero to one, the new primitives, and how this really tight alignment of security and liquidity, which has been a challenge historically for every other chain, shapes up with you guys. So it's very exciting. So thanks for coming on, Smokey. Real treat. We've been wanting to do this for a while and I'm glad we got it done. I think it's at the really pivotal time you guys are at, and coming out of Bearpalooza, coming out of, you know, it testnet. Any parting thoughts? I guess where can people find more about the ecosystem if they're interested in? Are you hiring as a builder or just general parting thoughts?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, man. A, appreciate the kind words. It's been a pleasure. B, you know, when we think about next things for us, we're going to be expanding pretty aggressively geographically, you know, on the tails of a race. So we already have a few different outposts, as I mentioned, but we're probably going to be doubling down and spending more time in Asia, and then after not too long, Latin America and then Africa. So we're thinking a lot about Southeast Asia, so Vietnam, Thailand, you know, Indonesia, Malaysia, you know, outside of SEA, also Japan. I'm looking for more folks who can help over there because I think there's a massive tide turning. Funnily enough, you know, this is perhaps a shocker for some folks, but Bearchain does not have like a formal marketing team at the moment. Like, we got one guy who helps with like events and a little bit of guerrilla marketing. But a lot of it is just sort of organic autism.
Shocking. That is probably the most shocking thing I've heard in this pod.
Honestly, because I think the thing is, like, I haven't found someone yet where I'm like, yes, I believe that this person is the right degree of native and capable of execution to hand over like some of the reins for how we try to execute things. So that's also a position that we'd love to see someone take up over time. Actively fielding candidates right now for, you know, folks across Asia, and sort of like a head of marketing CMO type of role. And then beyond that, you know, for anyone who wants to find me, I'm normally pretty accessible on Twitter. DMs are a little bit of a mess more recently, but working through them, I try to have one night where I just zone out every week and just respond to like hundreds of messages. So, you know, Smokey the Bear on Twitter. And beyond that, I'd recommend just reaching out. If you tag someone from the Bearchain community on Twitter, there's a pretty decent chance that it'll find its way to me or my teammates' desks really quickly. And we'll find our ways to help you in whatever way we can. And I think the last thing I'd say is that, you know, if you're a builder, if you're figuring out where you want to go next, and if you're looking for a new home, for example, and you're building something that you think is cool, new, and interesting, you know, please do hit us up. We believe that we are firmly in a services industry as people, you know, stewarding a foundation or helping to build a chain. It's our job to make your lives easier and our job to do everything we can to help you guys win on Bearchain. Because if you guys win, so do we, right? So if you're building something cool, hit us up, Twitter DMs, you know, email, whatever it might be, and we're there to help.
Is Build-A-Bear a meme?
Build-A-Bear is real. It's Build-A-Bear.
I see that percolate, so I love it.
Yeah. It's very much in like a same fashion of like, how do we set the bar high for the ecosystem, and also demonstrate to some teams of experienced builders that we can help them end to end, whether that's go to market and product strategy, whether that's narrative positioning, whether that's fundraising, and I think you guys will probably see much more come out of that in the next little while.
All right.
Awesome.
Smokey, again, thank you so much, man. And I think we're going to have to catch up soon once you go in. And we're going to have you on and maybe a couple of cool builders, maybe the Shogun guys, maybe some of the validators to get some an added dimension here into the discussion and especially proof of liquidity. I'm incredibly excited. And thanks for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course, man. Thanks so much for having me. I'll catch you.
Hey everyone, Jason here. Thank you so much for watching today's episode. Wanted to take a quick second to thank today's title sponsor, Arbitrum. We know you are tired of on-chain experiences that have unaffordable fees and frustrating transaction speeds, and that's why we partnered with Arbitrum. You can experience frictionless trades, lightning speed, and lag-free transactions, all for pennies per transaction. Explore Arbitrum's expanding ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. That's portal.arbitrum.io. See you for the next episode.